On Psych in the City, we'll be discussing grief. A friend of mine, Lucy Morin, recently completed training and became an end-of-life doula, which I had heard little about before speaking to her, and I think it's really, really cool. On this episode, we're going to talk about what an end-of-life doula is and could be, all the roles that they could take on. We're going to talk about the dying process and death and dying, and not only the dying process, but how we approach death and grief systemically. Finally, we're going to talk about grief and sex and sexuality, and how if you're grieving, your sexuality can and often does shift. I think about grief, and more specifically death, a lot. And for someone who thinks about death a lot, I've thought less about how grief could affect my sexuality, which I think is a symptom of how I've been conditioned to think about grief and about sex. So I think this is a really useful conversation to have and to be a part of, especially as we are right around several anniversaries, such as COVID. And anniversaries can bring up a lot of emotions and have us feeling many things without really knowing why we're feeling those things. So yeah, that's what we're going to be talking about today. Grief, death, and sex. And before we get started, I'm going to introduce Lucy. Lucy Morin is an end-of-life doula, sex educator, and a baker. As an educator, she is interested in providing people with kind, accurate, and shame-free information about their bodies. As a doula, she offers care and agency to people who are going through death and grief through food delivery, memorial making, and ritual support. For inquiries about doula work or zines, please contact her at lucimo91@gmail.com. And for those who are interested in becoming an end-of-life doula, she recommends The Dying Year, www.thedyingyear.org. Lucy, I'm really excited to have you on today. We met during our sex educator training, which, are you done with yours?
Not quite yet. Okay. I still have some stuff to do.
Me neither. But okay, good. That makes me feel better. But but we met, we're doing an assignment, and I discovered the type of work that you were doing, and I was so intrigued by it, and I'm so happy we can have this conversation. So Lucy, introduce yourself, tell us kind of like who you are and what type of work and trainings that you've just completed, because that's what we're going to be talking about today.
Okay. So I'm Lucy Morin, and I'm in the middle of doing a sex educator training with you. And mm-hmm. also in the fall, I just completed a training to be an end-of-life doula, which is being able to support and empower people while they go through the dying process and also afterwards through the grief process. And which is something that I was called to do for a long time, but the pandemic and just the massive amounts of death around us really made that more urgent for me. So that's when we were talking, I was so excited because I always want to talk about death and grief and find there aren't that many spaces that are excited to hear it. So I'm really glad to be able to have this conversation.
Why do you feel that when you say that it's always been your calling, like what made you realize that?
I think that I'm realizing only now in my adult life that the pros and cons of being an empathetic person. And so I think I've always been drawn to the stronger emotions in a room. And often that is more of the like emotions that aren't seen as negative. And so I feel like I've spent a lot of my life holding and supporting people while they're going through hard things. Mm. And I think when I started seeing that as something that, first of all, not everybody does naturally, because when you're a kid, you just think that whatever you are is what everybody else is. And I think it realizing that not everybody's drawn to those places.
Yeah.
And also realizing that if I was going to embrace that part of myself and not kind of shut it off and numb it, then I was going to also have to learn skills to be able to like continue being empathetic in the world and protecting my energy at the same time. So for me, both becoming a sex educator and having that like official training and understanding of the subject matter, and also the end of life doula program, is kind of helping me fortify skills and knowledge so that way I can continue being in the spaces that I'm already feel the most comfortable in without being able to go home and also still have my own self that I'm taking care of at the same time.
Yeah, I when we were preparing for this interview, you had mentioned that also how you felt that like birth and death are really interlinked. And that a really pivotal moment for you was that when you noticed just how culturally or socially, you know, in the United States, like these things are kind of like assumed but not discussed in a real way. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So when I was pregnant a few years ago, I was, you know, trying to find kind of any information, because that's how I calm myself. So I was like, okay, I'm pregnant and I don't know what I'm doing. And
right.
I want to know what's going to happen to me, you know, right. and just on a practical level. And I found that there was this wealth of knowledge, you know, about what's going to happen when you birth and like all the things that might happen to your body, but you don't learn it unless you are pregnant. We don't teach it and we don't understand it. And people don't talk to you about it until you're pregnant. And kind of going through the experience of trying to find out my own information and how taxing and kind of sad that was, to do, the midwives and the doulas that I was lucky enough to have for birth were so helpful in that process. And one of the things that I found that was comforting that we talked about earlier was reading these birth stories. So there is this book by Ina May Gaskin, and it's just a bunch of essays, and it has kind of personal accounts of different births. So like, it's like 30 stories in a book. And the reason why it was so calming was because you never sit in a room with 30 people while they tell you what it was like to give birth to the baby. Like, it just doesn't happen. And so you don't have the knowledge that's being passed down that I think culturally we used to have that passed down because we were closer to birth and also closer to death. So to have those stories that were all very different, and everyone has their own different emotional responses, but the phases of birth are still there. Like they may be changed in an individual level, but there's like, this has to happen before this has to happen. And then that happens. And it's just calming. And in those stories, there was one story that was about a woman who found out while she was in labor, early labor, that the baby she was birthing was already stillborn. So she was going through the labor process knowing that she was grieving. And that story, when I read it, was the one that I thought, okay, I can do this. Like, I can birth this baby, I can do it. Because when I read that story and understood the stakes, you know, of what bringing life into the world is, it was kind of the only time that I felt like someone had pulled back the veil and said, yeah, this is a really otherworldly experience you're in, and you have no control over the outcome. And knowing that was actually very empowering. And when I was in labor with my kid, I thought of that the entire labor, and it was what calmed me down, because I thought, okay, I know that I have it in me to grieve, and I know I have it in me to also go through this labor, and I can, and whatever the outcome is, I have to do this. Like, it's a tunnel I have to go through. That was one of my first ideas of thinking that we don't talk about death just the same way we don't talk about birth, and how that kind of it throws us into this wilderness of these very animal experiences that we will all encounter, you know, like, even if you don't ever give birth, you, there are people in your lives will, and also you were birthed and you go through that experience of becoming in the world, and everyone will die. And yet we don't look at it and actually acknowledge how massive it is.
And it's the same thing with sex, you know,
yes,
it's like
exactly
majority of us will have sex or at least be sexual beings in some way. We are sexual beings. And mm-hmm. so it's also the same approach that we take to these like massive events and experiences that like are what being human is. And we just like, it becomes this way over there taboo kind of thing. And no wonder we're terrified of it, because we don't really have this accurate, real, like real people information to like help us learn what actually goes down.
Exactly. Yeah. And you think about like, you know, and I feel like within, when you think about sex, I feel like there's more of a cultural conversation happening now.
Yes.
That silence and shame and stigma, like how much damage that does to our bodies and our choices. And that idea of there being topics that you only talk about when you're already in them, you know, like our cultural yes. way of having yes. the sex talk is you have one talk and it's uncomfortable and overwhelming and you don't really have answers, and then no one ever talks about it with you again.
It's and all reactive.
It's yeah. And it's fear-based, you know, it's all right. fear-based. And then most of us never have a conversation, you know, growing up with our parents about death, unless somebody we love dies. It's not prepared, you know, it's not linked to like the world we're in. And it, and when you really zoom out and think about this, that's really fascinating, because there's death all around us at all times, just like there's life, you know. If we were more connected to the fact that we're one species on a planet of many, many species, instead of this exceptional, you know, above everybody else species, and we could link constantly for the children in our life, oh look, that is dying and that's birthing from it and that is growing, and there's a cycle all around us always for life. But what we often do is hope it doesn't happen, you know, like
right.
hope
yeah.
that the kids in our life don't have to experience hard things. And, you know, then whenever it does, we're, I think, very unprepared, because we never had those conversations as children either. So we don't know how to meet them in that space.
And also even as adults, right? It's, you know, I've had in my own mental health journey, like I've had obsessional like death thoughts, which I think were completely fear-based, because I was mm-hmm. like, I don't know what happens. I don't know how this goes. Like I, you know, it became a little bit obsessional for me. And then the only time that I've reckoned, even as an adult, with like this idea of death is like when somebody that has been close to me has died, or the potential that, you know, my parents or that people I know, like preparing for, you know, the logistics of that. And again, it's like, I didn't have these conversations as a child, only when they were right, only when they were unavoidable. And even then they were still avoidable. And then now it's like, I still haven't reckoned with those feelings for myself, because it always seems like something you don't have to do. And it's not necessarily, we don't live in an environment that fosters that type of thought, you know?
I think that thinking about the environment or the structures we live in is so helpful, because I think before you go on, I just wanted to say, like, I think sometimes what is so hard as adults to learning new things or like unlearning our old beliefs is the shame that we don't have the answer, or that we did it wrong for so many years, or whatever that is. And I think it's helpful to zoom out and realize, well, culturally, we don't have this foundation on purpose,
yeah.
you know, like we weren't taught this on purpose because it doesn't benefit the way our society runs right now to have us really understand the weight of dying.
What were some of the things in your training and like in your work, like what is a grief and end of life doula? And then what are some of the tasks associated that in your work you could potentially be helping people do?
So I would say that in my training, the range of how long an end of life doula can help like a family is so wide. It could start from when someone's diagnosed with a life limiting disease, you know, it could start very early if someone has the foresight, you know, or the want to have support kind of to plan ahead. And it also can go as far as like months after a death for bereavement support. So it's grief support as well. And the way that a doula can show up is pretty wide right now, because I think there's such a hole, you know, like we have such a big need in so many areas. So you can get support for like getting your affairs in order, making sure that you have the right documentation, which most of us aren't taught how to do that, you know, up to making sure that we have our requests for care in the hospital written down, and making sure that we have the people who we want to be our healthcare proxy, like have conversations with that person to make sure that we're on the same page of values. You know, I think that's even when adults have those people on file of, okay, if something happens to me and I can't, you know, I can't communicate, this person will make decisions for me. They often don't have those ongoing conversations about, here's what's important to me. Here's like, not just, I don't want this procedure or that procedure. Just like, it's important to me to be able to hear people's voices.
Yeah.
Or it's important for me to be able to be there for my children as long as possible, like just values, because sometimes that's easier, makes it easier for the person to make decisions for you than just a list of things you do and don't want done to your body, because sometimes the decisions are more gray area. So an end of life doula can help facilitate those conversations, because it's uncomfortable to have that conversation without a third party there sometimes. An end of life doula can help with just like logistical support around the house. You know, some people want to make sure that they've cleared out their house and labeled things that go to certain people, you know, before that helps them feel like they're prepared to let go.
Yeah.
You can help with legacy projects, which could be something as like, the first thing I think of is like writing letters, you know, but it can also be something as long-term as having letters for many years for your family members that you like on their birthdays for multiple years, have letters that you've saved. And before taking the training, I never even thought about how that would be so comforting to know that for the next 10 years, my kid will get a birthday card from me, you know, we'll know that I thought this much ahead of about them.
Yeah.
It could also be something like a scrapbook or like a memory book or a video recording of their wishes or something you want to leave behind. It can also be like just supporting a family in caretaking. So it can just be like, I can run groceries for this family, or I can make sure that I cook soup for them so they don't have to think about cooking while they're taking care of their dying loved one. Or I can sit by the bedside so that way people can get sleep, you know, in the last few weeks of dying. Just being kind of a caretaking support for the people who are there all the time and don't necessarily have the time to be processing because they're doing all of the labor of caretaking.
Yeah.
It can also be, you know, planning for their, helping people have their wishes for how they want to have their funeral, you know, like what things are important to you, what things aren't important to you, what songs you want to play. There's also a different, slightly different part of being end-of-life doula that you can have a different training for, which is a home funeral guide. So it could be like, you can help if you have that training with people having funerals within their homes. And also be able to learn how to do green burials. So that's like a thing that people are becoming interested in again, because it's just better for the environment in lots of ways to be buried in the ground without anything, something around them, a casket or a cloth that composts back into the earth. And so there's different choices. And I think a lot of being an end-of-life doula is just reminding people that they have choice and they have agency over what happens to their bodies throughout the dying process and after death too. I think that's like the biggest support you could give to someone, because I don't think that we even consider that.
Yeah.
There's also, you can also be there with them during, because some people don't have caretakers or don't have ongoing support, right? So you could be the person who drives someone to their doctor's appointments and takes notes for them while their doctor's speaking. Because sometimes if you are hearing really scary things from a doctor, you're not remembering it necessarily, because you're being flooded with, wait, how long do I have? And wait, what's going to happen to me? And there's so much fear that it's helpful sometimes to have a person next to you who's not emotionally involved, right? They're not someone you have to protect. They're not your kid or someone who you know is also going to be having those big emotions. Just a person who's sitting and all they're doing is just taking notes and reminding you of questions that you wanted to ask the doctor, because that often is something that you forget. You leave a doctor's office and you go, oh God, I really wanted to ask about this medication I'm on, or I really wanted to do this, but I just got so overwhelmed by the fact that they said these really scary things to me that now I've wasted this appointment, you know?
Yeah. Is that also part of the work, like educating surrounding either the person or their family members about the dying process itself? Like, I mean, I don't even know the process, both logistically and body wise, of like, is that something that would happen? And if so, can you speak to the dying process at all?
Yeah. So I think that's a huge part of it, because I think what you were speaking to earlier was just the fear of not knowing is so much of, I think, what we think is our fear of death is actually the fear of not knowing, like, what's going to happen to me.
Totally. Completely.
And obviously there's, you know, so many different beliefs of what happens after somebody dies. Right. And that is a huge unknown, but there's actual physical signs, especially if somebody has an illness where it's not a sudden death, if it's a slow kind of descent into death, it may look slightly different. And it's like birth in that way, where like everyone's labor will be different, but there's markers where you can say, okay, like if someone's birthing, you can say, okay, they're this much dilated. I know that means that we're probably in this phase, you know, and it calms the person. And it also calms the people around them to go, okay, I know where we are. Like, I know where we are on the map of this, and I can orient myself to letting go, you know? So I would say that, like, there's some basic ones, that there's an emotional and a physical kind of withdrawal that happens like a month or so before someone dies. And this can waver, because sometimes people go almost towards death, and then they kind of like something in them just goes, nope, I'm not doing that yet. And then they come back. So there's sometimes when someone's dying, it kind of can wobble. But the first sign is that there's a withdrawal, like they're more internal, they're less talkative, they physically are just kind of slowing down, like things slow down in their bodies. They're not having to use the bathroom that much. They're not wanting food as much. You know, that's a usual sign that something's kind of slowing. They start sleeping more and kind of just drawing in. And there's lots of thought where that's like a very necessary way for them to also psychologically like get ready, you know, to let go. Cause it's a very charged thing, right? To decide to understand that that's what's happening. And then when you get closer to death, like a couple, like a week or so before death, there's more of like a disorientation, like a person sleeping a lot more. They're more asleep than they are awake. And when they are awake, they're not quite sure where they are, you know, like it takes them longer to figure out whose voice it is, where they are in their bedroom. They may wake up and, like, if they have tubes, like totally forget that they are hooked up to things, you know.
Totally.
Where maybe before that they were more aware of that, cognizant of that when they woke up. There's kind of a thinning of the veil that happens where they could be, you know, talking to a person. Like you could walk into a room and a person who's dying, like getting closer to death, could be saying, oh, I just spoke to Aunt Susie, and Aunt Susie's been dead for like 10 years, you know, that they're having conversations, or where they say that they're seeing people who aren't alive anymore. And that's like a very common across the board, across religions, like a common experience, not just something that's attached to a belief system. So I think it's just an interesting thing that something happens where you maybe, I don't know what happens, but right. time isn't as bound to now, I would say, you know, that there's coming and going. And then there's physical stuff that happens where like their blood pressure gets lower. There's a lot of body temperature things. People are either really hot or really cold. Like there's not as much middle ground, and they start, their skin color changes. And I think that's a big thing that I didn't know to prepare themselves for, that the person that they love who's dying, their skin is going to get kind of bluish or yellowish. It's going to seem like they're very jaundiced, like something's wrong, yeah. You know, but it's I think if you're not prepared for that, it seems very startling. But that can happen like a couple weeks before someone dies. It doesn't mean they're about to die. It's just something that happens because of the flowing of the blood stops happening as much, because your body's conserving energy.
Absolutely.
And they can also be a lot of coughing or like choking on their own fluids that can also be very scary if you don't see it coming. And it's sometimes there's lots of simple things, like hospice nurses have lots of easy suggestions of like making sure a person's propped up, and that you can, like, there's these things that you can suck up fluid and snot, you know, from their nose, just because their lungs are starting to not filter as much as they normally would. And if you're not prepared, it's a scary kind of noise. It's like a gargling noise that can happen when they sleep, but it doesn't mean that they're choking or they're suffocating. It just is a noise that they're making. And then as you get like hours before death, then there's like more of that congestion happens. The breathing can really slow. Their eyes can be open, but they're not seeing you. Everything gets more purplish on like your edges. And a person doesn't seem as responsive. But the thing that's interesting is that they still hear. The hearing is the last sense to go. And so if you know that, then you know that they can still hear you. You can still be talking. You can still be playing music they love. You can still be sharing stories. And
is that most of the time across the board that the hearing is the last sense to go? Interesting.
Yeah, it's just a universal thing. For whatever reason, hearing is like, has been scientifically shown that's like, people can still hear, and they respond in slight ways on their faces and in their bodies when they can still hear you. So that's always useful to know. And also just something to, as an end of life doula, you like to remind the family that both to, as a comforting thing, but also, you know, they're, even though they may seem like they're asleep, they hear you. Yeah. So maybe more delicate conversations, more intense emotions, more like negative feelings, you know, don't have it in the same space, because I think it's just the same way that you would if you were in a room with a child, you know, you wouldn't be yelling or things to keep in mind. And also in a way of comfort, like if you've planned ahead with your loved one, or even just if you remember, oh, mom loves this song.
Right.
That still is helpful in those phases.
And I really work from the framework in education of like, the more people know, the more they can consensually move forward, right? Because the less scary it really is, because it's like a lot of, you know, then if the loved one starts to cough a little bit more or, you know, and this doesn't apply to every situation because there is a lot of sudden death, but like it makes it so much, it really humanizes, I think, also the person that is dying, because even the way we often treat, or, you know, the framing of like getting older in our society, it's like those, it's like we do it in a way where like those people lose agency or something, mm-hmm. or like lose, I don't know. And so it really, it's to me, it just really takes personally, just takes so much of the fear out of certain things if I know what to expect. And even if the things that I can expect are a little scary in and of themselves, just knowing that they are typical for what is going to happen or that they could happen really just takes so much of the fear out. And I feel like that's why it's so important to just have someone there explaining like, oh, hey, this is totally, you know, even if you've ever been sick or at a hospital or something, it's just like knowing and being able to expect certain things to happen really takes the fear out of it for me.
Oh yeah. And I think also what you're speaking to, which I think is so important for almost everything in life, is just to normalize it, to say, yes, like, this makes sense to me. Like, this is valid and you can expect it and there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
This is what, there's no value system on it. Like, this isn't a negative or a positive. It's just, this is what happens when a body shuts down.
Totally.
And, if you know, for example, okay, when, you know, my loved one is making this really scary gargling noise, not only is it normal and I've been told it's going to happen, but also there's ways to make it less scary, like making, yes, sure they prop up and making sure I, you know, I can use a suction on them and I can, you know, I can, it empowers the caretakers to also be able to make choices that make it less scary for them. You know, if the noise is really bothering them, they can ask the hospice nurse to give them tools for it, you know. And there's, in some cases, if that's really bad, I think there's other things that a hospice nurse can prescribe, like medications, or I think there's other kinds of swabs and stuff that they can help you with that. But if you don't even know that that's something you could ask for, then you aren't able to better take care of yourself and the person who's dying in the moment. And I think the idea of having, like what you were saying about body autonomy, as you get old, I think that we wouldn't even have to have this conversation. And also we wouldn't even have to have end of life doulas if we gave everybody body autonomy for their lifespan. Like, if our culture was built off of the idea that everybody is the expert of their own body and they have agency, then that would just naturally change the way we have to talk about death, just the same way it changes the way you have to talk about sex.
Yeah.
And I think this, knowing that there are like structures that are there in our society that make it harder for people to empower themselves around death and sex, and it's not just a personal failing, you know, that it, there's actual lack of structural support that we could have, I think that is sometimes really empowering, just to know okay, this is normal and I could have been taught this and I wasn't. Like, I could have been taught this for my whole life.
Right Yeah, it's like this was always here.
Yeah.
I want to shift a little bit and talk about grief.
Yeah.
What is grief? And I guess, I mean, you know, I was taught like the 5 stages of grief. I think many people know that reference at the very least. Like, is that true? Can we talk about it? It's never felt right to me, but I want to hear your thoughts about it.
So I think what's interesting about knowing about the 5 stages of grief is that the researchers who made that all started off by making the stages of dying, right? Mm. So they're like one of the main beginning people who had these stages of dying, like this one stage, like emotional stages of dying. And so when they made the stages for grief, they also want it to be the same way that what I was saying about dying, that there's, here's things that may come up and they go through this, you know, here are different ways to do it, but they're not going to show up the same way for everyone, you know? And so I think that when you actually read the five stages of grief and you're taught it, I don't think they were ever intentionally meant to be first you do this, then you do this, then you do that, then you do this, and then you're done, you know?
Yeah.
Or maybe they were meant that, but I think that over time, that's not true, you know?
Yeah.
I think that a useful way to think of the five stages is that to use them as a way to normalize the strong feelings that come with grief, but not to look at it as a map, because it's not what it is. I think that grief is this ongoing, never-ending process.
Mm.
You know, I don't think there's an end. I think there are ways you can move through it and be transformed by it. But I don't think that there's a way to rid yourself of it.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think that if you know that it's not going to be like, there's not an end point that you should be, if there aren't the shoulds, which I think often the five stages, the way they're used now, I feel like they can shame people into these ideas of, well, I felt angry, so now I should feel this, you know?
Yeah, no, they're very should forward.
Yeah.
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 Go ahead, keep going.
And I was going to say that just the idea that there's no no time frame, and that it's a universal experience, you know, to know that there's so many different animals that have grief rituals that we've witnessed now that we can like study, and it's not as animals, you know, it's universal.
And you know, and we had talked about this, you had brought this up, which I thought was so interesting when we were preparing, about even the way we approach grief and death societally. Like you had mentioned, like bereavement leave for jobs, it's like 2 days, or like structurally, like laws and the leave time. And it really is, it's very like, oh, you get this time and then you should be over it. And that it's kind of this event rather than a journey and a process that takes time. I just thought that was so interesting. Because it's true, it has seeped into even the structural components of like employment.
Yes, yes. I think that there's so many similarities to how we deal with birth and how we deal with death. Because when we had talked about that, I linked it. And I think about all the time about the absurdity of maternity leave in our country specifically. It's not even universally given. And when it is, like, I feel like a good maternity leave in our country is like 3 months, which for anybody who's had a baby, you don't sleep for like at least more than that. And so to come back to any sort of normal, without, also most jobs don't have then like lots of other time for sick leave and other things that may come up when you have an infant. And a lot of places it's like 2 days, it's 3 days. Like someone could have to go back to work a weekend after they've been birthing someone, and that, and it with dying, you know, the idea that you get, you know, most people, if they get bereavement leave at all, it's like for the funeral.
Mm.
Maybe a day after a funeral.
Absolutely. And
for anyone who's lost anybody, half of that time you're in shock. You're not even necessarily feeling the weight of the grief or the loss that you've had. Yeah. And I think that when we don't, without these structural supports of like, you know, comprehensive, like really good education about death, and also the human need for space when you've lost something and someone who's important in your life, and giving that time. And it sends this message, aside from it being damaging to our health to have to go back to work and push down a lot of our natural process of grief in order to stay employed, mm-hmm. and how unhealthy that is, and how that can lead to so many different ways of coping that hurt you in the long term. There's that part of it, but there's also, what is the message that tells you? It's like, the message is, this is something private, and this is something for you to do on your own. This is something for you to do quickly on your own. And I think that grieving can feel so lonely. And I'm not convinced that that's a natural part of the grieving process, to feel that lonely. I actually think that is a structural failing, that we have people who are grieving feeling like they have to hold it all alone, because in different times of our society, and in animal species, and in different parts of the world that don't have this individualist capitalist need for everyone to go back to work immediately, grief is held collectively. It's held up by a community, and you don't have to hold it all by yourself. And I think that I don't think that something as massive as understanding that death will impact everyone, you know, because I think also when you lose someone, you also have to really face, okay, death is coming for everyone. And that is a huge existential thing to hold without having these people around you mirroring, yep, I see that. That is scary. Yep, I also have that feeling. I also know that. The normalizing and the holding and the support, I think, is what we naturally would be doing. And I think that when you just to zoom out even more, grief is so powerful. I think often what happens, because we have to hold it alone, is it ends up being a destructive power to ourselves. But I think that if we hold it collectively, it's actually this massive power for social change, you know, because when you think of like almost any massive social movement that's like been successful, or it's moved by dying. It's moved by all of my people are dying. You know, all of my people are being left for dead. And that collective acknowledgement of their grief and the outrage, you know, that there's a failing, that everyone is dying and it's not our fault. You know, everyone is dying when they don't have to die. That energy is really fuel for policy changes, for laws to change, for societies to like crumble and rebirth. And it's a really powerful emotion and experience. And I think that when we know that, it's almost more infuriating that we don't have these basic supports, because then I think what I believe is that we're purposefully not given these supports because grief is too powerful in terms of our society. Because if we all had this acknowledgement on a structural level, when someone dies in your life, you deserve this much time. Like, that's how massive it is, that you deserve this much time off. Then we would not be able to all sit by and watch death be performed on such a massive scale through all of these wars and conflicts and pandemics that are mishandled by bureaucracy. You know, like, if we culturally were shown constantly that our dying matters, it matters deeply and it affects us, and here's the social supports to remind us that, then the way our capitalist and like white supremacist culture behaves would have to change.
We approach death as so individualistic, and I mean, at least in the United States, and And even with the pandemic, it's like, there's, you know, it's this obsession with moving back to normal. And it's mm-hmm. like, this isn't normal. This isn't no, like, first of all, the normal was also weird. And then now it's like, it's just this obsession of just like, oh, like it's, and you know, I work in a hospital right now, and it's just this obsession with business as usual. And I mean, really the, like the bereavement leave and like structurally how we approach and really the message that it's sending of like, yeah, this isn't important. Kind of like keep it moving, get it, you know, get it going. This isn't, you know, you need to keep, and also the way it's rewarded, right? Like, oh, this will help you move through it. This will help you in right. that. Oh, you know, just like, you know, kind of like push through it. It's just, it's incorrect. And also there's no proof that it's true collectively.
Yeah, exactly. It's based on a lie, you know, it's based on a lie because psychologically, like, it's not true that if you just keep running from a thing, it won't catch up with you, you know, that like when people push down, like it's a real, aside from the fact that when we're talking about the pandemic, like it's causing more deaths to be pretending things can go back to normal.
Yes.
It just does. It's frightening how this need for normal without examining, well, what is that? Like, what do I really need? You know, what do I mean by normal? Was normal beneficial for us? Was it a collectively good normal? You know, is it something I should even be wanting and fighting for? Which is what I think is interesting about grief is that it can be a portal, you know, like it can be this black hole force where you look through and you go, wait, actually, none of this was what I wanted, you know? And I think like it can be a transformative force but you have to look at it. And you have to go through it and acknowledge that that's what you're going through. And I think when you were speaking, I was just realizing, I wrote down that we're all grieving right now. Like we just are, even if we haven't lost anyone, like even if we're lucky enough in this pandemic that we don't have a personal, like, fresh grief, we are collectively grieving. Our species is going through a massive death. It's just, it's like if we were a big forest of trees and there was just like millions of us were now done, like just flopped over. Even if we're still alive and all of our family's still alive, there's no way to look out and say, oh wow, there's this whole forest is gone. And in our animal bodies, we know that and we feel that, but because we don't as a culture already talk about death and talk about grief as this thing that can show up in different ways, we point at it. And I think a lot of times people are pointing at it as like, and saying, well, I feel really anxious right now, or I feel really burnt out right now. And those things are valid too, but I feel really lethargic. I feel so depressed. I feel all these things. And those things can be other things, but without the context of we're living through a massive death, then they seem like they're a personal failing. They think like, well, I really wish I could go to work, or I wish I didn't feel so weird. But when I'm having so much anxiety, I don't know what's wrong with me. And I think that that's why I was so excited to have this conversation, aside from the fact that I just like talking to you and I like talking about death, was just that I think that it's right now, without peeling it back and saying, oh, I'm grieving, then there's no way to actually let down our guard and say, oh, I'm grieving.
Yeah.
And then something can happen. And then you can say, okay, well, I need something then. I need to actually do these XYZ things because I'm grieving and I can acknowledge that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It does. It turns it into a personal moral failing when it's really not that at all. it's a natural, you know, valid response to what's going on.
I was gonna say that just, I think that so much of the pandemic response, the way that it has been happening, has been to not look at the thing, you know, to not look at what we've lost. And I think that, you know, any massive dying, you know, whether it's a war that people live through, or like my ancestors, like a Holocaust, or any of these things, like the trauma that gets passed down, there's trauma that gets passed down no matter what, but there's a different layer of trauma when that isn't spoken and looked at and pointed at and named, and just goes into the behavior or the way of coping without even saying like, oh, this has happened to us. You know, there's a separate danger on top of it.
Yes. Yes. I want to also talk about grief and sexuality, which, you know, two things that are rarely spoken about, and then how they impact each other, because I do feel like in the realm of sexuality and in the realm of grief, like the other is not often connected to the other one. And I guess, you know, with what you know and what you've experienced, like, how does grief affect our sexuality? You know, like, what can we expect if we're talking about how, you know, looking at our expectations and looking at what we know is a way to help us cope? Like how can grief impact our sexuality?
Yeah, I think that grief shows up in the body. And I know that's like a very simple statement, but I think that because we don't talk about grief that much, I think that isn't necessarily like obvious. Like it's like, just like how we're now starting to talk about how trauma shows up in our body. Like, it's not just in our head, it's in our body. And I think grief also shows up in our body. And so there's lots of different ways that someone can process the massive emotion of grief, but there's a, like, sometimes when someone's grieving, it can make them feel really numb, like just very numb. And like, there's no pleasure. There's nothing, like there's not any sort of sensation, you know? And so they go seeking, you know, to kind of feel human again, to feel like they can feel things, situations that are heightened, you know? So like someone can go and start over exercising, or like doing like really adrenaline-y kind of risk-taking behavior when they're grieving. And if that person is doing those things, then they also might, because they're seeking more intensity, like really reach to sex, you know, reach to sex in a way of like an intensity to feel in their bodies, because it's not really different from the same idea of like, you know, my mom just died and I don't feel anything, so I'm going to jump out of a plane, or I'm going to go run like 10 times a day, or I'm going to even like just lean into addictions or lean into anything that makes them feel more, you know, not even like better or worse, but just more, just something, feel something. Yeah.
And it's a way to get back to ourselves a little bit, or try an attempt.
Yeah. To like kind of slam back into our bodies, you know? Yes. So like to feel like we're not floating. Sometimes when you're grieving, you feel like you're not quite in your body, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that having, if that's your way of grieving, then leaning into your sexual activity and really like intensifying that activity, it can be something that you're reaching to as a tool to be like, oh, here's my body. Like maybe I don't feel it when I'm walking around all day, but right now I can feel myself, you know? And that doesn't necessarily mean that having sex would be pleasurable in the same way it normally would be, but just in a way that it's a tool to feel something, you know? But then other people, it can take them out of their body in a different way. And it can make them feel like not want to be touched at all, not wanting to be close or intimate, because it's like a wound, like it's too much and they don't want to be seen. Because you know, sex can be very vulnerable, and to really let that guard down and to really be in your body, you know, that for some people can be a huge aversion, you know, like it can be something that somebody doesn't even want to participate in, you know, their sexual activity goes way down. And I would also imagine that it would go in a Venn diagram of people who also kind of withdraw in general from the world when they're grieving, because it's kind of keeping their energy close.
Yeah.
And turtling up and kind of not wanting to be seen or known, like feeling too raw to really be participating. And I would also say it can change your desire. It can change what you desire. And it can also change like how you come about feeling desire. Like it may make it so you're not feeling like on your own spontaneously, oh, I really want sex. But like if you feel like there's a situation where someone else is desiring you and is like trustworthy in that moment, that you can then warm up to the idea. Like it may not be something that you want the same way that you would before someone who you loved died. It may change the way you go about sex and feel empowered within a sexual relationship.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that we forget that, like, you know, I feel like with sex, we forget this too, that like it, your body, you know, sex is in your body, and like, it's not this separate, you know, part of your life that's like all the way over here, shut off in a door, and it's not going to affect the rest of your life. And grief and death, I think, is the same, that like, it's kind of be over it's going to affect all aspects of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And they all interplay with each other.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that also where it can be, you know, I think it can be intimidating for a partner or a, you know, any sort of, you know, relationship, even just friends. Like it can be hard to know what to do with the person you love who's grieving, because we don't talk about grief. And so if grief comes up in a sexual situation and the person themselves don't have the words or the understanding to know that it's grief, it can be very hard to understand what's going on, you know?
Yeah. How can we be supportive partners if a friend, you know, our partner or somebody is experiencing grief that we love? Like, because also we're definitely not taught how to do that either.
Yeah. I think what's so interesting is that we know how to show up for some things. And for some reason, grief is one that we just aren't shown, but I don't think it's that different. You know, I think it's different because it reminds us that we're going to die. And I think it feels like this huge chasm that we don't want to fall into. So we sometimes don't want to be around people who are grieving because it makes us think of our own mortality, and that's overwhelming.
Yeah.
But I would say that, you know, if someone in your life is grieving, normalizing, hey, you know, it makes sense you feel this way because your mom died last month, you know, even if they're not saying that's why they feel so bad, to remind them that, you know, that you remember what happened, you know. I think we sometimes don't want to say the thing. We don't want to say, oh, well, I know that your mom died, because for some reason we think we're going to remind them of it and it's going to make them feel worse, but they know all the time.
Yes, right.
You know, and it can be a relief to know that you're seen, that your grief is, you don't have to explain to people why you're feeling weird, you know. I think the biggest thing we can do is to normalize for our partners or our friends, the people in our life that we love, that we don't know what they're going through. We're not gonna ever be the expert in it, but that it's not something we can't comprehend, you know, that it's not something so foreign, hey, you know, your mom just died and I just wanted to check in, you know, is this what you want to be doing right now? Or would you rather be, you know, watching a movie with me? Or, hey, I've noticed you seem like you haven't been eating a lot lately. Would it help you if I made dinner?
Mm.
Just little things that if just naming what you're seeing, you know, and normalizing it.
They say that with, you know, people who work in suicide prevention also talk about, you know, if somebody that asking about, if you're concerned that somebody is feeling suicidal, that asking directly, you know, we have a similar fear of like that talking about it directly will somehow give the person ideas or will make them want to do it more or something. And in reality, the opposite is shown, is that you're actually showing and demonstrating to that person that you are not fearful of these conversations and that you are a person who is able to have these conversations and that they can speak to you about that if that's what's going on. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, it also relates to death, you know, of like this double fear of like something scary, you know, a scary thought that I think many people can relate to. And then also the idea of like that also this potential, you know, this again, this looming idea of death. And I totally agree that normalizing it, it feels so basic, but it's also like, because it's not normalized in a larger context, you know, like we don't. And so individual normalizing it for ourselves, I think can be really useful because it's not normalized in a larger context. You know, the larger context of culturally and socially is that we, you know, kind of, you know, like we said, it's a private experience, like, you know, move through it on your own time, you know, and then kind of get back to what, you know, get back to life. And that doesn't have to be the way we handle it, you know, even though that is rewarded mostly.
Yes, that's such a good point, the reward and the cultural expectation. And I think that because we have that cultural expectation of how grief is supposed to look, which is mostly based off of us being able to make money, us being able to live in a society where we're good workers,
right?
It's not actually based off of any knowing of ourselves or any like
connection to our emotions. Yes,
exactly. Yes. It's just, when can you get back to the factory?
Yeah.
That's it. You know, and before we were an industrial society, those expectations weren't there as much, you know, and because that is what it is now, there's a lot of shame. There's a lot of shame if you are, you know, if your mom has passed away or your brother has passed away or somebody close to you has just died, but it's not the week that they died. You know, it's not the 2 weeks after,
right.
It's like maybe 6 months after, and you still don't feel like your full sexual self. You still don't feel exactly how you did before. The barrier to even be able to have that conversation with your partner is because there's shame and there's an expectation that you should be normal. And so to normalize it for them as the partner or as the friend to say, hey, that makes sense, because if my mom died, I would not feel normal yet. That doesn't make, you know, that makes sense to me. You make sense to me.
Right.
And I think we underestimate how much saying to somebody, you make sense and you're valid, in a society where most of us don't feel like our experiences have ever been validated, can really, really allow for the safety to have those difficult conversations. Like what you were saying of that you, with suicide prevention, that you're showing the person, I'm able to have this conversation with you. Like, I'm emotionally stable and understanding of myself that I'm able to have this hard conversation with you. You don't have to protect me from your feelings. You know, right. Like I'm okay. And I want to know what's going on with you from an actual, like, I really want to know.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
And I'm not going to freak out, you know, that I am here and I want to hear it. I think that is one of the biggest gifts we can give to anybody, and especially when they're going through something hard. You know, there's this great quote that was said in my training, and it was that because you're talking about how when you're a doula, you're companioning, right? You're the support. You're not leading people. And I think that because we have such a hierarchical society, we kind of forget that that's a really important role, you know, to just walk with somebody while they're going through something hard without having a solution or rushing them through it, just to walk with them.
Yeah.
And there's this quote that is from a bereavement counselor, Dr. Alan Wolfett, and it says, "Companioning is about going to the wilderness of the soul with another human being, but it's not thinking that you're responsible for finding the way out."
Mm.
And I think about that almost every day, because I think that it takes the ego out of it as well. Like,
oh, totally. With any type of care work.
Yeah. And I think that with grief, I think a lot of times why we don't want to touch the subject of someone we care about is grieving, is that we are like, I don't know how to help. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to fix it. Like, death is so big, and there's nothing you can do to remove the fact that someone they've loved has died. You can't.
Yep.
And I think to remember, that's not actually what's being asked, you know? What's being asked is to be a witness and to give care, you know? I think when someone's grieving, they sometimes feel removed from their body, and that means that they sometimes forget to eat, and they sometimes have trouble sleeping, and they don't necessarily have the bandwidth to like schedule childcare and do all the minutiae of little things that human beings have to do in the world right now. And I think offering that just tangible support, like, hey, you know what, I can pick up your kids from school so you can have more time to sleep, or hey, I dropped off a soup outside of your house just so you don't have to think about cooking. Or those are the things that really we think of as really small and insignificant, they could never possibly fill that void, but those are things that really help people remember, oh, you care that I live, you're caring that I stay surviving, you know, through this hard thing.
And I think about that so much too, even as being a therapist. I feel like my own nature is to, there can be times where that you just want to help, but then you're almost immobilized by the idea that you don't know what to do. And so then the option is that you don't know what to do. And really, it's rarely the ask, right? That's rarely the ask. The ask is mostly just like, at its core is, hear me. Mm-hmm. I want to be heard. I want to be supported. I want to be acknowledged that, yeah, this is really hard. And especially with something like death, like, we're not going to fix it. We're not going to fix it. We're not going to fix that a person that you love and that you care about and that, you know, has passed, or that you yourself are going to pass. And that really, I think, just being able to truly and deeply hold that with somebody, you know, like the companioning part, that's what it is. It's not, and I think we can talk ourselves out of that in like, that's not what somebody needs, but really at the end of the day, I mean, I'm coming to terms with like, that's really a lot of the times, most times is the ask, you know, and that's really what we need. Many of us need the most. We don't need solutions. We need just to be held.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that when we can sit with that, when we realize, okay, we just need to hold each other, then we get to have this kind of mycelium network of care and mutual aid towards each other, where if one of us is going through something hard, there's resources we can send over. And then if another one of us is going through something hard, there's resources. And like, you know, my kid is really obsessed with just learning about nature, and the trees, that's how they stay alive. You know, they have this whole network of funguses that connect their roots, and they send each other extra resources when one of them is going through like a disease or something.
Yeah.
And that's how you keep us all alive, is by sending over just little bits of care that you can send over that doesn't diminish your own structure, you know? And I think that ritual is a really important part of that, because sometimes it's hard to hold these big feelings on our own without there being these ceremonies or rituals that can just kind of help us tap into the fact that we are not the first person who's felt this before. And that can be really healing, just that alone, to remember like, okay, I'm a human who's lost somebody, and there have been humans before me who have lost people, and there are humans after me that will lose people, and I can do this. Like, I can do this hard thing, you know?
Yeah. And I wanted, that was something that we had talked about before. What are ways that we can help ourselves move through grief, or like acknowledge our grief? And I know that you had wanted to talk about the idea of like rituals surrounding death and grief. So let's talk about that for a second.
Okay, cool. I think that the only way through it is through it, you know? So I think what we already have spoken to is just naming, oh, I'm grieving, or yeah, I think we're both grieving. That's the first step. But I think that there's something to be said for also having containers in your time, in your day, that all you're doing for that moment is grieving. And then you can kind of shelve it, or it's not so overwhelming. If you're like, okay, for 5 minutes, like something very small, for 5 minutes, I'm going to light a candle, and I'm just going to think about my grief. And then I'm going to blow out the candle. And that seems so simple, but what it actually is doing is it's saying you're safe for this small time. And it could be shorter than 5 minutes. It could literally be 20 seconds every day.
Right.
But just to say, this is where I'm at right now. And holding that for yourself and empathizing with yourself and saying like, that's okay, you know? And then going about your day, it can be simple as a small ritual, but I think what I wanted to talk about was this idea of like queering our rituals, because I think that for so many of us, either we didn't grow up with religion, or we did grow up with the religion and then it like harmed us, or we see the structures of religion and we see like the patriarchal structures and the damage that can do and has done over the world of organized religion. And so then we throw it all out.
Yeah.
You know? And I think what's beautiful is remembering that like the beliefs and the bigger ideas we can take and discern what is useful, what isn't useful. And one of the reasons why religions, I think, were even one of the many reasons why they exist in the first place, is to help us make sense of things that are too big to understand. And death is one of those things. And so to just remember that there's a reason why people have created these rituals, even if we don't agree with the religions or the idea of religion at all, even if we don't believe in there being an afterlife or a higher power, we don't need those beliefs to be able to understand that there's collective behaviors that we kind of need to go through these big feelings. And so like we can queer them and we can change them. We could take what we want and we can make them ours. We can make them something that has our values. Mm. And so like with my background, the Judaism, which I'm picking apart as an adult and figuring out what I want and what I don't want. But with death, there's a couple traditions that are just really brilliant of like, there's sitting Shiva. So after somebody has died, the immediate family, they don't do anything for a week. They have to sit on low chairs and people have to take care of them. Like it's written in as a ritual. Like this is what has to happen.
I love that.
And so like, regardless of what you believe, like the brilliance, like the ancestral brilliance of saying, no, 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 you're going to sit down. You have to sit down, and other people have to come to the house, and it's built in already. You don't have to ask for help. You don't have to say, hey, do you mind if you come over and help me? Like there, people already know that when someone dies, this is what we do.
Yeah.
We go over to the house, we bring food, we make sure they're okay. We sit with them, we listen, we tell stories about the person they have lost. Like every day for a week, we do this.
Yeah.
It just is embedded that it's a community supported grief, you know? And the other thing that is really brilliant that I think about often is that in the Jewish tradition, there's something that happens a year after somebody dies. It's called an unveiling.
Uh-huh.
Which is when you actually take a cloth off of the gravestone. So when somebody's first buried, there's a gravestone and then they put a cloth over it. And an unveiling is when you take the cloth off of it, or sometimes it's also when the gravestone is actually put in for the first time. But there's a ceremony around that, and the idea that there's a ceremony there is also an acknowledgement that for the first year, you're not even consciously understanding all the way what you've lost. That once you've done the unveiling is when the grieving really starts. And I think that most of us aren't living with that all the time, you know, but it is true that the, you know, when you've lost someone important in your life, the first year you're just trying to keep your head above water. And then you start thinking, oh, okay, here's another birthday, here's another thing, and they're not here. You know, it starts to really sink in that somebody's not there. So I think to create our own rituals that reflect what we actually believe in, but to not give up rituals around death, you know, that there's so many different ways that we can approach it that are healing for us, you know, like to make memorials or monuments to the people that we've lost or the things that we've lost, you know, because we can grieve not just people, you know, we can grieve like an idea of what we thought our life was going to be, or a relationship ending, or like the world not feeling safe. There's so many things that we're grieving, and to really make something from it, you know, to make art or to cook food, you know, all these different ways that you can make it, but to consciously think of it as something you're doing to process guilt, grief, and to not feel guilty about taking that time, I think is incredibly healing.
Yeah, I love that. And I love what you mentioned about, you know, sitting Shiva, about how it's built in so that you don't have to ask for it in a way. Like it's just assumed everyone's on the same page, because a lot of times it's just even having the space to think about what we need and seeing what we need. It's so fundamental and important, and also not given in the grief process. And I really like the idea of, you know, taking of like ritualizing and like querying the rituals that maybe we know that never really fit for us, or that did make sense at a time, but no longer suit us, and kind of making them our own and allowing that to help us move through it.
Yeah. And I will say that I think that, and I know I don't want us to take too long, but I just, I was thinking about how we, like my normal way that I thought was just my natural way of grieving is to be numb, you know, and to reach for kind of numbing behaviors.
Yeah, or numbing agents.
Like I was like, ooh, this is what I, and so in my head, I was like, that's how I grieve. Like, that's just right. What my grief is. And this fall, my Aunt Jean passed away, and it was after I'd taken this course and become certified. And so it was the first time that someone had passed away where I even thought of other ways of approaching grief, you know, that not just going through my base, like animal way, or not even animal, I think is very human. I think is actually our way of not being animal, but not reaching for the things that I normally reach for. And because I throughout the pandemic, I have been sober because I just already kind of, when the pandemic happened, was like, I think this, I know that this is not good for me. Mm. And so it was the first time that someone had passed away where I wasn't drinking or smoking or doing any kind of numbing behaviors yeah. that I normally already was doing. And I was very moved by how, when I kind of didn't have those crutches, I really relished, like really it brought me pleasure almost to make an altar for her or to take pictures of her and put them in frames and light a candle under it and just kind of naturally making this kind of altar, which I had never experienced before, and kind of just naturally created my own little ritual to get through those early stages of grieving her, and it was really beautiful to see that because I had just taken this class and had just all these options kind of given to me, like you could do this or you could do this, that once I had those options, I reached for them.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it's so powerful to give people options about what they, how they want to go through an experience, because, you know, you can't change what is happening, but to give people options, little lifeboats to try to help them go through this huge feeling, it really does help to have a reference point. Because I think if you only have a reference point where when people die, people drink and they don't talk about it, then it's really hard to then think of a different way to do it.
Totally. Absolutely. Oh, Lucy, thank you so much. This was so beautiful and helpful. Where can people find you or contact you if that's something, like, do you have anything that you want to share?
Oh, okay. I'm not really on social media anymore, okay. But yeah. Because it's not good for me particularly right now.
It's really not. I seriously agree. Yeah.
But I love getting emails from anybody, and I've written a bunch of zines about sex ed, but also about grief and dying. So if anyone is interested in those, you can contact me through lucimo91@gmail.com. And I'm like very interested to talk about dying with anybody. So, at some point I will put together some sort of a website or something for my end of life doula things. But, anyone's interested in becoming an end of life doula, I will highly recommend the program I did, which was the Dying Year.
Okay.
And it's just fantastic.
I will keep that in I will put that in the show notes as well.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. So, and I didn't know about your zines. I'm really excited to read them and email you about them.
Also, one more thing, Lucy provided a lot of great resources, and I just want to list them here. The Artist's Grief Deck is a wonderful resource for prompts to move through grief during the pandemic. It has artwork and rituals and can be accessed at griefdeck.com. If someone is interested in finding certified end-of-life doulas in their area, they can look through the directory in the National End-of-Life Doula Alliance's website, www.nedalliance.org. And a great resource to start having conversations around death and dying with your loved ones is theconversationproject.org. They offer free guides and conversation prompts to tackle difficult subjects. As always, thank you for listening. My name is Sarah Kelleher, and I'm the host of Psych and the City podcast, the podcast you are listening to. This was an interview between me and Lucy Morin, who is an end-of-life doula, sex educator, and baker. If you want to talk to Lucy about doula work, zines, or death, you can contact Lucy at lucimo91@gmail.com, lucimo91@gmail.com. If you want to message me, you can find me on Instagram, psychinthecitybk. You can email me, psychinthecitybk@gmail.com. If you want to come on the podcast, if you want to talk to me about something, feel free to reach out. Thanks.